One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
I'm David Knowles, and this is Ukraine, the latest. Today, we bring you the latest news from across Ukraine. Hear the stark and moving story of how Ukraine gets back the bodies of its fallen soldiers. And we catch up with Ukrainian volunteer Dymko Zlutenko to speak about how his work has changed over the years and how Russian soldiers are acquiring valuable Starlink systems.
Bravery takes you through the most unimaginable hardships to finally reward you with victory.
If we give President Zelensky the tools, the Ukrainians will finish the job. Slava Ukraini!
Nobody's gonna break us. We're strong. We're Ukrainians.
Every weekday afternoon, we sit down with leading journalists from the Telegraph's London newsroom and our teams reporting on the ground to bring you the latest news and analysis on the war in Ukraine. It's Tuesday, the 2nd of April, 2 years and 38 days since the full-scale invasion began. And today I'm joined by our senior foreign correspondent Roland Oliphant, foreign correspondent Isabel Koshiv, and Ukrainian volunteer Dymko Zlutenko from the Dziga's Paw charity. I started by asking Roland for the latest updates from Ukraine.
There's quite a lot to get through. So in no particular order, starting with this morning's news, there's been an exchange of attacks on infrastructure in both Russia and Ukraine. So the big headline-grabbing event overnight, early this morning, is that several people were injured in a drone attack on industrial sites in Russia's Tatarstan, local authorities said. So I'll just go through the details and we'll talk about the significance of this. So the Russians say that two drones attacked a dormitory on the territory of the local special economic zone, saying that two people were injured. The MASH Telegram channel, which is a Russian Telegram channel, said a third drone hit a factory, and that appears to have been Tatneft's Tanico oil refinery, which is just up the river Nizhnekamsk, just a few miles down the Kama River from Yelabuga. Pictures of the scene suggest that that drone hit the core unit, which processes about 155,000 barrels of crude per day, which is about half of the plant's annual refining capacity. And this is obviously in the context of several weeks of Ukrainian drone strikes on Russian oil refining capacity. Reuters has an interesting estimate that so far that campaign has shut down about 14% of Russia's refining capacity. So that the TASS actually put up the injured from this strike to about six people later on. There's also some questions about what was actually hit in Yelabuga. So the Russians claim, and there is already some geolocation work that's been done online, which I haven't had time to go through myself and verify, but it seems to stand up. It suggests that what's been hit is actually a dormitory housing workers rather than the actual factory which they were looking at. And the factory seems to be a production site for Shahed drones, the drones that the Iranian design drones that the Russians have made a very big use of throughout the war, really. Now, the significance of all this, sort of burying the lead here, is that this is probably the deepest drone strike into Russia that we've seen so far. So it's more than 1,100 kilometers, so 700, 800 miles from the front line to Nizhnekamsk. Incredibly long way. Tatarstan, if you look at a map of Russia, it's well beyond Moscow. Now, the Russian media is attributing this to something called the UJ-22 Airborne, which is a large drone developed by UkrJet. Now, if you look at the official sales brochure online, which I have done, it says it only has a flight range of about 800 kilometers, so that wouldn't necessarily reach that unless it's been modified in some way. Others have speculated that the strike may have used a light aircraft, given that incredible range. And there is a video that something that looks like it might be like a single-seater Cessna light aircraft crashing into the drone factory. Now, the UJ-22 does look a little bit like that, actually, and I haven't been able to look at it to absolutely rule out that that silhouette is not a UJ-2022 as opposed to a light aircraft. But what the Ukrainians have said previously, just a few months ago, actually, was that we have been developing long-range drones with a range of about 1,100 miles there. Moving on, the counter-strikes by the Russian Air Force conducted a massive strike on Sunday on Ukraine's energy infrastructure and the gas industry. Russian Defense Ministry said it involved high-precision, long-range air-based weapons. The quote, earlier in the weekend, on Saturday, one of Ukraine's largest thermal power plants was destroyed by Russian shelling, according to Center Energo. The announcement came just after Moscow carried out a massive barrage of missile and drone strikes across central and western Ukraine. The Zmiv thermal power plant in Kharkiv region badly damaged March 22. This is Andrei Huta, the chairman in charge of the Centergo Supervisory Board, told Interfax Ukraine, quote, the consequences were destructive. The station is destroyed. There were many direct hits. Everything we prepared in preparation for the winter was destroyed. So that's power outages scheduled in place for around 120,000 people in Kharkiv region. 700,000 people lost electricity in the immediate aftermath of the strike on Zmiv. Now, this brings us to the Kharkiv situation. And Kharkiv does seem to be perhaps one of the most serious situations it's been in since the start of the war. So Ihor Terekov, the mayor of Kharkiv, gave an interview to the Liga Net, a Ukrainian media outlet, on April the 1st, yesterday. And he said Russian attacks have destroyed almost all of Kharkiv's energy infrastructure, including that thermal power plant, all the electrical substations. He said, we don't know what Russia's plan is for these intensified attacks, but the private energy infrastructure is also destroyed. Russia wants to intimidate us, but this is impossible. The points of invincibility, he says, are still working. There's those little, it's often just a room or a cellar or a few rooms in a building where with a generator where you can go and charge your phone and stuff that were set up in towns and cities across Ukraine to provide just that basic little bit of support for communities that had lost their basic utilities earlier in the war. Those are still working, but this is a really major, major issue. This is Ukraine's second city, and we've reported over the past week or so about just how dire the situation in Kharkiv has been without electricity, without water. So definitely something to watch, because we know there's a lot of this rhetoric about a long-term Russian plan this year to launch another attack on Kharkiv. So keep an eye on that. Now, turning to the battlefield, away from drones and down to the actual front, a lot going on, but I just want to focus on two things. The first was this apparent quite big Russian failure over the weekend. So this is unsurprisingly published by the Ukrainians, but it seems to stack up. So Russia lost up to 20 armored vehicles in a single failed attack in the Donetsk region. This is around the area of Avdiivka. So the story goes that the Russians put in an attack of 36 tanks and 12 BMP infantry fighting vehicles as part of a large assault northwest of Avdiivka on March the 30th. Now, this is being reported as one of Russia's largest mechanized assaults since the start of the war. I must say, I'm not entirely sure about that or what kind of parameters you're talking about there. I mean, if they're talking about a specific attack on a specific small section of front, perhaps that's fair. There's certainly a large number of vehicles to put into one particular thrust. The aerial footage of the assault was posted by the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense. It shows a convoy, at least 9 tanks and armored vehicles advancing on a dirt road, come under heavy fire. The ministry said it was Ukrainian paratroopers of the 25th Airborne Brigade repelled the attack near Tonenko village. 4 tanks and 2 IFVs destroyed. But Ukrainian military bloggers reported the footage was only part of Russia's losses. One anonymous serviceman saying that a total of 12 Russian tanks and 8 armored vehicles were destroyed during the assault. The 47th Separate Mechanized Brigade claimed it was responsible for the deaths of nearly 1,300 Russians, destruction of 28 vehicles, 1 tank and 17 vehicles. So lots of images from the site. If you go online, you'll see a lot of videos of these tanks running into trouble and being taken out one by one. Some of that's been geolocated to this road northwest of Tinenka, which, as I said, is a village kind of 8 miles west of Avdiivka, which fell to Russia in March. So the Ukrainians pushing out that incident as an example of how, you know, Russia's still trying to put in these big assaults, but is being held up. a story of Ukrainian success. But there is another point in the front I'd like to draw your attention to, which is Chasiv Yar, which listeners probably recall is a town just to the west of Bakhmut. During the Battle of Bakhmut, it was a kind of a key logistics hub, one of the last roads into Bakhmut that the Ukrainians controlled, went through Chasiv Yar. It is now, it seems, on the verge of becoming a battlefield itself. So basically, Russian troops appear to have gained a foothold on the Chasiv Yar Heights. Chasiv Yar is on an area of high ground between Konstantinovka and Bakhmut, and they seem to be pressing forward with the campaign to capture the town. So this comes from Roman Pogreli. He's from Deep State. That's an organization believed to be quite close to the Ukrainian authorities. It publishes one of the most authoritative control maps of the war. If you Google Deep State map, I'm sure lots of our listeners do, is one of the most reliable go-to places for recent updates of who controls what territory. A very useful resource. Anyway, he gave an interview to Ukraine's NV Radio yesterday, and I'm just going to read out what he said. Heavy fighting is now taking place precisely for the village of Ivanovskoye, which is located near Chasiv Yar. The Muscovites have repeatedly stated that they've taken complete control of the settlement, which is not true. Our military is fighting. They're holding back the onslaught. But unfortunately, they have already reached the heights of Chasiv Yar, which should never have been allowed, because it had seemed to have been previously stated that engineering fortifications were being built for the defense of Chasiv Yar as a whole. But as you can see, they have already come close, so the question remains open. So again, this issue of has Ukraine dug in, has it actually done the things that it said it was going to do when it was talking about digging trenches? Where are the trenches? He continues to talk in this interview about where are these defences? Were they talking about somewhere else? Either way, the Russians are much closer. They've reached the height that is located north of the village, and that's Ivanovskoye, which is basically a little bit to the east of Chasiv Yar, which puts both the fighters who are in the village and the logistics in an unpleasant situation. Now, the Chasiv Yar Heights are important for the following reason. Basically, in that part of the Donbass, you have two parallel valleys with rivers running basically south to north. One of them is the Bakhmutska River, which is where Bakhmut is, which is now in Russian hands. The next one is the valley where the Slaviansk, Kramatorsk kind of conurbation area is concentrated. That is the big conurbation that's still controlled by the Ukrainians. It is the big prize of the campaign for Donetsk region, basically. The Chasiv Yar Heights lie in between those valleys. And during the Battle of Bakhmut, there was a lot of talk about how the Ukrainians had already prepared defenses along those heights, so it would be impregnable even if they had to retreat from the city. It sounds like that is now somewhat under question. So there's going to be big pressure here for the Ukrainians to try and push the Russians back, but the Russians are definitely going to be trying to dig in and consolidate that foothold they've gained. The current fighting on that front, the villages of Ivanovsk, there's another one a little bit to the north of that called Bogdanovka. Those are the places you're going to hear about a lot, I would say, over coming days and weeks as that battle develops. Devin, I'm just going to run through a couple of other things very quickly, because I know I've been speaking for a while. The 450-mile railway line Russia's building through occupied Ukraine to link Crimea with Rostov is almost complete. This is Kirill Budanov, the head of the GUR, Ukrainian military intelligence. He said, Russia's been building the railway for over a year now to connect with our temporarily occupied southern territories. The process is almost complete and could pose a serious problem for us. Now, we had reports of this from British Ministry of Defense. I think just last week they talked about this being nearly complete. So this is not necessarily a big shock. We know that it's been coming. The idea is basically you put in a railway from Rostov to Donetsk to Mariupol, Berdyansk, and eventually onto Crimea. That kind of eases up your reliance on the Kerch Bridge, which, as we know, is extremely vulnerable, has been targeted by the Ukrainians, and it also eases Russian logistical supplies to all their forces in that kind of long ton of land they're holding along the Azov coast over into Zaporizhia and Kherson regions. There's reports Russia is now using barges to protect its Black Sea port in Novorossiysk, according to the Ministry of Defense. So there's satellite images that show Russia's positioned four barges at the opening of Novorossiysk port. This is a port in Russia, not in Crimea, on the Black Sea coast, where they've moved a lot of their Black Sea fleet since following the Ukrainian strikes on Sevastopol. An effort to enhance the defences of the port against attacks from Ukrainian uncrewed surface vessels, by which we mean maritime drones. That's from the British Ministry of Defence. Vladimir Putin has signed a decree setting out the routine spring conscription campaign, calling for 156,000 citizens for statutory military service. This got a little bit of play on Twitter yesterday. I just want to mark it because this is routine, right? This happens once or twice a year in Russia. It's mostly 18-year-olds being called up to do their compulsory, I think it's 18 months these days, or maybe just 1 year of military service. Under Russian law, these are people who cannot be deployed to the war. This is not the great big mobilization that everyone's been talking about of drafting more people for the war effort, unless Russia changes the law. So he signed the decree. It's happened. We had these reports of maybe the Kremlin calling up 300,000 more men for an assault on Kharkiv. That's not it, but worth being aware of that. Meanwhile, my last little update, there's more fortifications being built in apparently the Kyiv region, which I think talks to the kind of vulnerabilities people are feeling about the current direction, the current tide of the war. So nearly 10,000 defensive concrete pyramids, dragon's teeth, set up in the Kyiv region, according to the regional governor, Ruslan Kravchenko. Protecting our border is one of our main goals of security policy. He's obviously referring to the Belarusian border, from where the Russian invasion, the Russian strike on Kyiv came in the first months of the war. Volodymyr Zelensky announced in March that Ukraine was building 2,000 kilometers of fortifications. And again, this links us back to those comments about Chasiv Yar. There's been a lot of criticism of the Ukrainians for not having dug these defenses earlier, of having squandered time when they could have been digging these things. And also there's some speculation about have they dug the things they've even said, coming from Ukrainian commentators themselves. And a lot is going to depend on that. That is, digging fixed lines of defenses is one of the things the respectable Western analysts have been saying that Ukraine's defensive campaign is going to depend on. The other one is, there's two other elements to that. One is conscription, finding more manpower, and the other one is, of course, Western aid, which, as we know, is still held up in Congress in Washington. And David, I'm going to leave it there. That, I think, pretty much runs us through war developments over the weekend up to lunchtime.
Well, thank you very much, Roland. You're right, there's a lot of updates to get through, and you did so fluently and brilliantly. So thank you very much, Roland Oliphant. Let's go to our second guest, Isabel Koshiv. Isabel, thank you so much for joining us. It's a real honour to have you with us. Can we talk about your article you've written for The Telegraph? The title is stark: Inside the Bodies Corridor, Where Russia and Ukraine Meet to Swap Their Dead. You travelled to the Russian border to watch an exchange of these of the bodies. Why did you go? What did you see?
Hi, thank you so much for having me. Yes, so we travelled to the border in mid-February with Ukrainian military intelligence. We went partly because it's something that I'd written about before and I'd been hearing about for over a year, and it is pretty secretive, and they had decided to open up a bit about it and given us this opportunity to go. So we went to witness it, but also to write this larger story about missing Ukrainian soldiers and the repatriation of Ukrainian soldiers to Ukraine, which is, as I wrote about in my article, a sort of huge multi-agency effort by Ukraine to help these families, these thousands of families who are searching for their dead or for their missing.
Could you take us into your reporting there then? Tell us what you saw. Talk us through the day you spent.
So we went up there late the night before and then left early the next morning for the border. We travelled up there in this very, very long convoy of vehicles. So it was police, it was the internal security services, the military intelligence, forensics, the Ukrainian rescue services. And then we travel from Sumy City right up to the border. And of course, the refrigerated vans of dead Russian soldiers that the Ukrainians recovered. And you kind of snake through all these small villages until you reach this border crossing point, which they've been using not only to exchange their dead, but also for prisoners of war. So it's an incredibly important point for Ukraine. And then the convoy stops and the ICRC, who a pretty key part of this exchange process. Their experts, they do a random spot check of the bodies because there are all kinds of procedures and rules of how the bodies should be exchanged. And so they do a spot check of the Russian bodies on this side, and then they have a separate team. These are international members of the ICSC. They're not nationals of either side. And they do the check of the bodies, and then the Ukrainian forensics drive the bodies over to the Russian side, where the bodies are offloaded and unloaded by the rescue services of each country. Lists are exchanged. So if there's any kind of identifying features on the bodies, those are marked down and on these lists, or if there are names, for instance, if their uniforms are still intact or any dog tags or anything like that, that's also noted. And then those lists are exchanged by the security services of both sides before they drive back to Ukraine.
Could you talk us through what has to happen for this exchange to go smoothly?
Yeah, so I mean, it's been the most successful bilateral diplomatic channel between the two countries since the war started, and it has continued on a regular basis since it started in late summer of 2022. So it happens every 2 to 3 weeks, and essentially everything has to be done by the conditions which have been agreed upon. So that is, nobody is armed during the exchange. Obviously, you do have soldiers on either side watching the exchange, but none of the individuals involved in the exchange are carrying arms. So that goes for Ukrainian officials, to the forensics, and of course, like the rescue services. And I think, of course, there has to be a bodies to exchange. It is roughly 1-to-1. But not always. So sometimes Ukraine's receiving fewer Ukrainians than it is giving. Sometimes the other way around, you know, I saw a notice of one exchange where they were giving 20, 30 more Russians than they were receiving Ukrainians. So they have to keep to the rules. But also the Ukrainian side is very, very willing to get its dead back. So from what I understood, from what they said, if it's slightly fewer, they're happy to agree to that, because for them, they said to me that the most important thing is to get back their dead and return them to their families.
You mentioned in your first answer the fact that this crossing point is not just used for the exchange of dead bodies, but also for prisoners of war being exchanged. One of the most tragic parts of your article, I thought, was this description of civilians watching the convoy and not necessarily knowing who was being transported. Could you tell us about that?
Sure, yeah. So as we were making our way towards the border, obviously it's a long convoy. Traffic has to stop to let it pass because it's a sort of dual carriageway. And there was this young boy, he excitedly stood in the road and was waving at us, smiling. And the military intelligence official who was in the car with us said, oh, he thinks we're going to collect prisoners of war. And, you know, it's obviously really sad that, no, we were traveling with refrigerated vans full of bodies and we were going to collect Ukrainian dead. But obviously, I think the adults know the difference, because when they come for the prisoners of war, they come with buses, not refrigerated vans. And so I think the adults had recognized this, and things travel by word of mouth in these villages, in these areas. They see the refrigerated vans go up. So when we were returning from the crossing point, and bearing in mind, as soon as the refrigerated van got over the border, we were out of there within seconds, because they have said that the shelling could start almost immediately. But as we were driving back through to Sumy, it was a few hundred people in total in these tiny villages. They came out and just lined the streets. And we saw one or two in the first very small village to start with. But with every village that we went through, and they get bigger as you go further towards Sumy, there was just more and more. And it was really emotional and really, really devastating. Of moment, you could see that these people were so personally grieved by seeing these vans come through and knowing what that means, essentially. So you had people kneeling on the snow, lots of people crying. It was a very emotional moment.
What happens, Isabel, to the bodies once they're back in Ukraine? And maybe tell us the story of Mykola Shatnyuk.
Sure. So once the bodies are back in Ukraine, a whole new journey begins for them, because actually, to process and to identify bodies which are in these states, because these soldiers have died from violent deaths. So their bodies are charred. They could be full of shrapnels. They might just be just bones. but they are unrecognizable to a very large extent. And so the process of processing the bodies, extracting DNA, testing the DNA, a lot of the time they have to go back and extract more DNA because the DNA samples they originally extracted were sufficient and they didn't bring up the kind of data that they need. So it can take months. So I'll give you the example that I included in the article, which was this case of Mykola Shetnyuk. So he was from Kyiv region. He had signed up to the army in 2014 on a contract and had been stationed in Kyiv region when the war broke out. In May 2022, after the deoccupation of Kyiv region, he decided to go to the front lines in Donetsk region. And I didn't include this in the article, or I included part of it, but he didn't actually tell his wife he was going to the front lines. He said he was going to be somewhere back from the front lines, helping the army fire service or something like that. And his unit was eventually surrounded in Volnovakhsh in southern Donetsk region around the time when Ukraine was pushing Russian forces out of Kherson region. And it's another sort of tragic tale because equipment, according to his fellow soldiers who survived, equipment was moved from where they were to Kherson region to help with that counteroffensive. And his unit was surrounded. And basically his wife started looking, and his wife started looking with 25 other wives whose husbands had also gone missing. And they couldn't get any information from the soldiers that he was stationed with at the time, because it's a very tricky situation when there's no body to say to somebody's relatives that this person is dead. And they searched telegram channels for evidence that maybe they were all being kept as prisoners of war. And she gave DNA samples at that time because of the blackouts in Ukraine. So you need two DNA samples to verify a match. So at that point, they were asking for one because the laboratories couldn't process two samples at once. So they would test the first one. If they found a probable match, then they would ask for a second one to confirm. So although her husband Mykola came back to Ukraine through the corridor in December 2022, so about 5 weeks after he died in October, the test wasn't actually carried out, I presume partly because of the blackouts and partly because it would have been so difficult to extract the DNA from his body. Until sort of March 2023, then another sample had to be requested. It had to undergo more tests. And it wasn't until June 2023 that she got the final confirmation and his body was released. So he died in late October and his body was released and buried in early July 2023. So it was eight or so months. So it was a very, very long time, and obviously a very upsetting and devastating time, as it is for all these families of the missing, because they simply don't know what's happened. And it's impossible for the authorities to confirm anything without the body and then without a DNA match.
But eventually his family did get closure. What did they tell you?
So he and his wife had been together since they were 13 years old. She's 33, so 20 years. So essentially, they spent their whole life together. And so although she said that she was happy to have the body, and at least now they had a grave to go to, it doesn't take away how devastating his death is for them. But ultimately, it is a form of closure. And the village where they live in Kyiv region, they did big send-off for him. And so I think in that sense, it was something for sure for the family.
Isabel, it's such a stark report from you going up to the border and seeing this exchange and talking to the families impacted. Is there anything we haven't spoken about or haven't asked you that you think is important for our listeners to hear?
I guess the only thing I would say is that it's such a huge amount of people who are searching for their missing. And the Ukrainian authorities has a lot of dialogue with these families, but it's a very impossible situation because you can only test and try and match the bodies that you have. And also I would say that there's part of the difficulty is some relatives, this is a minority we're talking about, but some relatives, they want to believe that their son, husband or brother, whoever is still alive. And they don't want to admit the possibility that they might be dead. So they steer away from giving any DNA evidence. And there was one sentence that I had in my piece, which was that the Kyiv forensics were telling me that there was a case where they identified a body, found a match, the body was buried, and then the mother came back several months later and said, no, I need you to do the test again. And they said, what do you mean? They said, well, I don't think it's my son. And the body's already been buried. So it's just a very, very difficult and awful process for everybody involved, but an important one.
Well, thank you so much, Isabel, for joining us. We'll come back to you at the end for your final thought. But let's go to our second guest today, Dimko Zlutenko. Dimko, it's wonderful to hear from you again. It's been quite a while since we've spoken. So would you just reintroduce yourself and your work to our listeners?
Thanks for having me. What I do is I'm just a Ukrainian who runs a charity, relatively big, over $2 million US dollars raised and spent for Ukrainian army. And we provide Ukrainian army with tech devices, Starlinks, radios, portable power stations, a lot of UAVs. And yeah, generally, I'm just well educated on the topic of technologies in this warfare.
Well, let's talk about Starlink then. I think that's something you want to speak quite a bit about. We've seen quite a few reports, I mean, this has been going on for months now, of Russian troops buying and using Starlink systems. What can you tell us from your perspective?
I can definitely confirm this. And given that I'm Ukrainian and I have this kind of a cultural and language similarities with Russians, I do have an insight into their social media in ВКонтакте and Одноклассники. And this clearly shows that there is a lot of evidence of Russians using Starlinks, of Russian volunteers or government agencies pretending to be charities, of them mass procuring those devices. And I am quite sure of how that works. So there is like a geofencing kind of a thing implemented by SpaceX specifically for Starlink, meaning that the Starlink wouldn't want to work in most of the occupied territories. At the same time, it would work somewhere closer to the front line. So this is exactly where Russians are using that terminal. And why they are using this is, like before then, Ukrainians had a very good technological advantage on this because Starlink, combined with other commercial products, gave quite of a technological edge and the ability to create the transparency over the battlefield, meaning that you have your any of your UAVs and you're able to live stream the footage from it to the commandment posts. So basically Russians are doing this now as well. And even though I have seen many of the reports of Ukrainian FPV drones taking out their Starlink terminals, they are just keep coming. And I have also seen a lot of evidence of how you can buy Starlink in Russia. It is very overpriced. So let's say in our case, we're just finished the project of buying 101 Starlink for Ukrainian army. And the average price for us was about 240 euros or dollars. So for them, it's about 5 to 7 times more. So more like $1,500 or $2,000. And mostly, as Starlink do not sell their products in Russia, this all comes from other countries that are basically allowing anyone to buy that device because that's a commercial product. And then people will just take it to Russia and then to the front lines.
And could you sum up for us the impact you think this is having on the front? Just how important is this? What do the soldiers you help tell you?
This is extremely important, and the fact that Russians are trying to acquire this technology confirms this. Basically, it enables battlefield transparency that in the commandment post, you are seeing simultaneously a good dozen of live streams from the part of the front that you are responsible for. So this prohibits any surprise attacks being done from both sides, because both sides have this transparency now. And Russians, they treat the drones as mobile cameras in the air that would stream footage to the Ukrainian, to their command posts. But that is nothing new. So Ukrainians did that since 2022. And I still recall in 2022, in spring, being one of the pioneers of that just by delivering Starlinks, portable power stations, drones, and tablets to the Ukrainian units. and then live streaming drone footage in like Google Meet or something. So Russians have learned from this and they are trying to do the same, although they do not have any technological capabilities of doing this in terms of the satellites that fly that low. So that's why they resort to using Western technologies for their war.
Dimko, you mentioned there that some of these Starlinks will be bought by groups of Russian volunteers who are aiming to support, I guess, their friends and relatives fighting. Do you feel like now your organization, Ukrainian volunteers, are in a bit of an arms race with Russians doing the same thing?
I wouldn't definitely put it that bold. There is a good piece of evidence that some of those organizations in Russia, they are basically funded by various oligarchs and government agencies inside Russia. But their job is to create that picture, that spirit of unity. But most of the time, people in Russia, they do not really care enough for this war to put their own money in, especially given how poor the economic situation is for ordinary Russians. And wealthy people in Moscow, they are not thinking of terms like, hey, maybe I could just buy 10 drones and then save 100 of my Russian comrades or something. This is not the mentality here. And I think this is pretty well the case in Ukraine, like the opposite, that we try to save our friends with that. And this is really the people's war. In Russia, most of the time, that's some kind of a psyop because of the amounts, because of the quantities, because of the reach they do have with their organizations, which is extremely low. At the same time, they provide 5,000 drones a month, which cost you a good like $3 to $5 million. Which doesn't make sense, right? Like ordinary Russians don't have enough of that money. And with 500 views on Telegram and Vkontakte, you don't have this kind of a capability. So, but yeah, there are some Russian volunteers. They are real, they are honest, but they are very small in that regard. So they would be delivering like 2 Starlinks per month or something.
That's fascinating. Thank you, Dimko. Can we talk a little bit more about your volunteering then over the past 2 years? What's changed for you? Could you give us a sense of how your work, the material you work with, has changed over since we last spoke, really?
So for us, it all started as a personal initiative back in 2022 of just me wasting my own money to help my friends. And then many people online decided, hey, this good guy, I want to chip in. So he would help his friends who are fighting. And grew as such into an institution with dedicated processes. Back in the day, I was an IT guy, so I led a lot of IT teams into the IT success, building products, and I have built many of the processes within the charity the same way as I would run product teams to build a bigger product. So we created a lot of that, and this have helped a lot. We also did this the transparency solution for all of the donations and all of the spendings to be displayed right on the website. I think that gained us a lot of competitive advantage. What really changed is that we went from one-man show into a good of organization with well-set-up processes and even sometimes looks such that I don't have much to do, even though it's a lot to do always. So, yeah, these are the main changes. What the soldiers are asking is actually quite interesting because we have a bit of insight into the Ukrainian bureaucracy machine doing the procurement, and some of the units that do their requests to us, we can clearly see that, let's say, we would do a fundraising for a month, right, to buy everything that they need. And by the end of the fundraiser, we would come back to them and say, hey, we got all of the funds. Can you just confirm that it's all legit? And they would say, no, we don't need most of that stuff anymore because the government just gave that to them. And I'm not talking like arms. I'm talking the technological stuff like tablets, radios, cars, and things like that. So that is very uplifting. And I would be very happy if the work of organizations such as I do run wouldn't be needed. But unfortunately, this is still not the case for most of the units, given the scale of the invasion. But that is very pleasant to see that Ukrainian Ministry of Defense and the procurement machine do their bit and do that very professionally, I would say.
Just one more question from me, Dimko, before we go to Roland and Isabel and you for your final thoughts. Unless, of course, Roland and Isabel have questions. But I remember when we talked before, you went out fairly regularly to the front to exchange, to give the soldiers the things you'd gathered. What's that experience like at the moment for you? I mean, has it got more dangerous? How do you feel when you're out there?
Absolutely. We do these kind of runs to get to know the situation better because, as you know, the technologies are evolving and there is a lot of software being built in Ukraine to enhance the operations of Ukrainian army. So we just try to understand as much as we can, as much as possible. Has it got more dangerous? I wouldn't say so. Or maybe we just got really used to it. Back in 2022, it was really insane, dangerous, and scary. Yes, but we were not the same back in the day. So now I think we are much more experienced and we know what is dangerous and what is not. And sometimes you could be literally having a night somewhere in the cellar and 3 kilometers from the front line and you are safe. But sometimes being like in the city center of Kyiv in the downtown is not safe, or in center of Kharkiv, which I visited recently, and just exactly when that whole massive attack of 15, 20 missiles happened at this city, which city still doesn't have electricity because of the missile attack taking out all of the electricity and infrastructure. So I think it got a bit safer, and we also, all the volunteers who go to the front lines, we got much more experienced, and the time has filtered out people, most of them who are anyhow just go there to show off, to do stupid stuff, to do any pictures, etc. So it's more of everyone who is there at the moment is very dedicated, I would say.
Dimko, it's been lovely hearing from you. Let's go to our, unless there are any questions, let's go to our final thoughts then. Roland Oliphant, you've been listening to all of this. What are your thoughts?
Hello. Thanks to both of you for coming on. I thought it was fascinating. My final thought, there's one other little kind of more diplomatic development over the weekend that I think is worth flagging because of the significance of its bearing on everything else. So the US House Speaker Mike Johnson, who obviously refused to allow a vote on Ukraine aid and then sent the House of Representatives off on recess, he was on Fox News yesterday and he basically intimated that he might bring that vote soon after Congress returns from the Easter recess on April the 9th. And he suggests that right-wing elements of the Republican Party are trying to unseat him over that. But that raises a little bit of hope that this massive delay to American aid may finally be unblocked. And just context, a reminder, I'm sure our listeners don't need any reminding, the fall of Avdiivka in February, the advance we were discussing earlier towards Chasiv Yar, the weight of Russian progress since the start of the year, all of that is explicitly linked by any credible observer of the war to this delay in really critical American aid, which includes all kinds of things. We're talking about air defenses, crucially we're talking about artillery, we're talking about howitzer barrels, we're talking about spare parts for Bradley fighting vehicles, everything. So that is a crucial hinge on which the future of the war is going to depend, and it looks like something might happen. So date for your diaries, April the 9th, Congress comes back from the Easter recess. It's possible there may finally be a vote at that aid package.
Well, thank you very much, Roland. Isabel, what are your final thoughts?
Thank you. Yeah, so I guess I would have to second Roland in the fact that this aid package is just so key for how Ukraine needs to balance its budget and finance things going forward. And without it, it's going to have to take some pretty drastic domestic measures, which is only going to further weaken it, to raise the funds for the army. And even then, it probably won't be sufficient given the US arms production and just the fact that no other country or the EU, for example, body can fill the gap left by the US. And then just on my story, one thing I didn't mention is this ramping up of DNA testing, which they're doing in Ukraine. And so getting soldiers now to give DNA when they sign up and things like that. So to speed up the process, I mean, the process in itself can't be sped up because each stage needs to be done in a certain order in order for them to be certain that they've identified the person correctly. But obviously, the more people that they have doing it, the quicker it can be. So I think that gives some hope to these families. But again, it's a question of these bodies coming back and the corridor continuing to function. So that's, of course, we have to see how that goes.
Thank you very much, Roland and Isabel. Dimko, would you like the very final words?
Absolutely. Would love to thank to everyone supporting Ukraine. Just as a Ukrainian, this is really touching to me that even after 2 years of this terrible war, there are still foreigners who are able to put their heart and mind in the support of Ukraine. So thank you very much for that.
Ukraine the Latest is an original podcast from The Telegraph. To stay on top of all of our Ukraine news, analysis and dispatches from the ground, subscribe to The Telegraph. You can get your first 3 months for just £1 at www.telegraph.co.uk/Ukraine the Latest. Or sign up to Dispatches, our Ukraine newsletter, which brings stories from our award-winning foreign correspondents straight to your inbox. We also have a Ukraine live blog on our website, where you can follow updates as they come in throughout the day, including insights from regular contributors to this podcast. You can listen to this conversation live at 1 p.m. London time each weekday on Twitter Spaces. Follow The Telegraph on Twitter so you don't miss it. To our listeners on YouTube, please note that due to issues beyond our control, there is sometimes a delay between broadcast and upload. So if you want to hear Ukraine the Latest as soon as it is released, do refer to the podcast apps. If you appreciated this podcast, please consider following Ukraine the Latest on your preferred podcast app. And if you have a moment, leave a review, as it helps others find the show. You can also get in touch directly to ask questions or give comments by emailing ukrainepod@telegraph.co.uk. We do read every message. And you can contact us directly on Twitter. You can find our Twitter handles in the description for this episode. As ever, we are especially interested to hear where you are listening from around the world. Ukraine the Latest was produced by Rachel Porter, and the executive producers are David Knowles and Louisa Wells.